It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's been a banner year for science. We'll talk to an editor from Discover Magazine about some of the top space stories from 2015.
First, President Obama delivered a speech from the Oval Office last night outlining his plan to take on terrorism and to try to keep America safe following last week's deadly attack in San Bernardino.
The speech was widely seen as a chance for President Obama to address the fear that many Americans are feeling about ISIS, and he spoke to those fears last night.
Here's what I want you to know. The threat from terrorism is real, but we will overcome it. We will destroy ISIL and any other organization that tries to harm us. Our success won't depend on tough talk or abandoning our values or giving in to fear. That's what groups like ISIL are hoping for. Instead, we will prevail by being strong and smart, resilient and relentless, and by drawing upon every aspect of American power.
On top of his attempt to inspire confidence among Americans, President Obama talked about efforts at home and abroad to combat terrorism and the importance of working with Muslim communities to take on the threat.
For more on the speech and the reaction today, we're joined by UW political science professor Andrew Kidd. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So why did the president use an Oval Office primetime address to say a lot of things about fighting terrorism that we've heard him say before?
Well, people are a bit jittery. People are on edge. There's been a lot of terrorist attacks in the United States, a lot of mass shootings recently. And so I think there's a sense that there's a little bit of fear out there. Things might be slipping out of control. And so he wanted to try to get people back on an even keel and reassure them and lay out what his strategy is for trying to address this problem.
And how did the president try to address the fears that people may be having about ISIS and American security right now?
Well, he outlined the strategy that he's pursuing. I mean, he used some rather ambitious rhetoric and set some ambitious goals, saying that we're going to overcome terrorism, which harks back to the civil rights movement, perhaps. We shall overcome this threat. We're going to destroy the IS, ISIL as he calls it. Those are very ambitious goals. It would be great if we could do that. It's not clear how we are going to do that. But his strategy that he laid out is basically what he's doing now, what the United States is doing now. We're going to use airstrikes. We've been doing that for about a year, targeting their leaders. We're going to try to increasingly put the screws on them financially, cut off their oil exports. We're going to try to ally with local actors, most especially the Kurds, but also some other groups in Syria, especially, who are fighting the IS. We're going to put some special forces in there to help guide airstrikes. And we're going to cooperate with other regional powers, especially Turkey, to try to seal the border and, again, cut off their financial supplies. And hopefully, the most ambitious goal, in a sense, to end the Syrian civil war. He talked about resolving the Syrian civil war, which is indeed the key to the whole problem. If you could resolve the Syrian civil war, you would really be able to do something against the IS. But unfortunately, that is a very ambitious goal because it's a very complex problem.
And the president's approval rating on how he's handling terrorism, it could be better. The GOP has been attacking him on this. Did this address last night do anything to possibly turn that ship around?
I'm not sure how many minds it's going to change. The Republicans, of course, came out very vehemently against the speech, accusing it of various kinds of weakness in one way or another. But it's interesting. It's not clear that the Republicans are really united against or united around a more obviously hardline approach. For the simple reason that we've been trying more hardline approaches in terms of large ground commitments in Iraq since 2003 and Afghanistan since 2001. And the government that we supported in Iraq was defeated by the IS in the north just in 2014. The Afghan government that we've been supporting all these years is showing significant weakness against the Taliban. So we are acutely aware of the limits of American power, even on the Republican side these days. And so there's a lot of quibbling about the details of what the rules of engagement are for the special forces and things like that. But nobody is really proposing the kind of commitment that it would actually take to wipe out the IS in a definitive way. Right? People have estimated it would take over 100,000 American ground forces to do that. And I just don't see any appetite for that across the political spectrum.
We're talking right now to Andrew Kidd, UW professor here in Wisconsin, and we're talking about President Obama's speech yesterday on terrorism and America's safety in the world right now. Now, the president, you said he did have some ambitious language. The tenor of his speech last night was very moderate in tone. He was plain-spoken about this. What do you think he's going for in his approach to how he's reaching out to the American people about this? Is he going for maybe more of a comforting role instead of alarmist?
Yeah, I think you could say that. I mean, he is, as he often does in these sorts of situations, he projects cool, right? He doesn't want to be flustered. He doesn't want people to get overexcited. He wants people to keep their heads. And so that's kind of the message that he's projecting there, that we can have these ambitious goals, but we're not going to achieve them overnight. It's going to take a long period of work and perseverance, being relentless, as he put it. So we need to sort of settle down and keep our eyes on the ball and do the things that work against counterterrorism threats. And these things are not big and dramatic. There's not a big invasion. There's going to be no date when the bombers, you know, unleash shock and awe. There's not going to be anything of that nature. And conversely, there may be no event on the aircraft carrier where we declare mission accomplished. It's going to be a long struggle. And we're just going to have to get used to that phenomenon.
And the president also referenced some things he wanted Congress to do. So among those things, barring guns from people on the no-fly list and also restricting access to assault weapons. Here's what he said.
I know there are some who reject any gun safety measures. But the fact is that our intelligence and law enforcement agencies, no matter how effective they are, cannot identify every would-be mass shooter, whether that individual is motivated by ISIL or some other hateful ideology. What we can do, and must do, is make it harder for them to kill.
Interesting bit of the talk last night. There was some speculation going in that this would be an address about gun control. It really wasn't. This was the one sort of chunk about that. How is this aspect unfolding, the no-fly list in guns?
Yeah, it's very interesting that a lot of people wondered what would happen in this country when Islamic extremists and terrorists started using guns rather than trying to blow up aircraft, because then sort of two conflicting impulses would come to bear. One, on the right, on the conservative side, certainly very pro-guns, anti-gun control, and also wanted to be strong on terrorism. And so far, we've seen the pro-gun side wins that debate hands down. The Senate just voted to not prevent people on the no-fly list from being able to get firearms. And so we haven't seen a lot of movement on that. Some of the Republican candidates, I think Trump among them, expressed an openness to the idea of preventing people on the no-fly list from getting guns, but others were vehemently against that idea and saying that, no, the list was a terrible list, lots of innocent people were on it, this is a constitutional right, et cetera. So I would say at least in the early running, the pro-gun side seems to be dominant on the Republican side. So we're not going to see, at least right away, a big move in favor of guns control, even in the seemingly limited context of trying to prevent people who are suspected of having radical Islamic sympathies and terrorist connections, much more than sympathies, terrorist connections, preventing them from getting weapons.
And the president also spent some time making the case against Islamophobia. What do you make of how he's approaching that?
Well, I mean, I think that's also good. It's definitely the right message to send, right? I think one of the goals for the IS in attacks of this nature, certainly the attacks in terrorists, is to try to divide Western societies along religious lines and try to make life uncomfortable for Muslims in those societies, turning non-Muslims against them, trying to thereby further radicalize Muslims in the West, which would, from their point of view, be all to the good because it might increase their ability to recruit people to carry out further attacks and to support the IS. So I think that's definitely, as the president expressed, one of their goals, and we need to fight that, right? And so I think his statements are efforts to do that, trying to say people, look, this is just a tiny, tiny fraction of Muslims. This has nothing to do with Islam per se. We should not be anti-Islam because of this any more than we should be anti-Christian because of the Planned Parenthood shooter's Christian beliefs. And so I think that's an important message to send, right? While at the same time trying to encourage, of course, mobilization, anti-extremist mobilization within the Muslim community itself.
Andrew, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks.
That was UW Professor Andrew Kidd talking about President Obama's speech yesterday on terrorism and American safety. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out how positive thinking took over American culture.
First, 2015 has been a banner year for science. So every Monday in December, we're looking at the top science stories for the past year, as determined by the editors of Discover Magazine.
Today's destination, space. We'll look at some of the coolest space stories from the last year with Bill Andrews. He's a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Bill, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much. It's good to be back.
Well, some of the most amazing pictures this year were of Pluto and the New Horizons mission there. Tell us the story of New Horizons and what it found.
Sure. Well, in a nutshell, New Horizons was the probe that we, and by which I mean NASA, sent out into space about 9 years ago in 2006. And after all that time, it took a long time to get there. It finally arrived at Pluto and its moon system this year in July. And it was, as I say, a long-awaited milestone, almost a decade out, traveling all that distance to get there. And it was the first time we'd ever seen any kind of close-up images of Pluto, the one-time planet. So it was a feat of engineering just to get there, and it's been kind of a wonderful moment for science ever since, getting to pore through all the data that is found.
So these pictures that were coming back, these were kind of showstoppers. What did they show?
Well, the first thing they showed that I think surprised almost everybody is that Pluto is not a dull, lifeless little world, which, not to be insulting, but since it's so far away from the sun, that's what a lot of scientists had thought, that it was not much activity was going on, and that it would just be kind of like the moon, but smaller and even less exciting. But it turns out that there's a lot going on this little tiny world, and they're still not really sure why. There's some regions that have a lot of craters, as you'd expect from impacts over the years, but a few plains systems that they're not exactly certain. Is it because new ice has covered up all the old craters? Has some kind of formation, another formation occurred there that they're not certain why? There are a lot of these red regions that have occurred, they think, because of interactions between organic materials and that have gone on in this completely different, harsh, cold climate of Pluto's. So it's just been one surprise after another, and it's a lucky thing for the public that it's kind of a beautiful, beautiful process to see unfold as well.
It seems like I kept seeing stories that started scientists surprised by blank. New Horizons kept finding new and interesting stuff. And it wasn't just on the dwarf planet Pluto itself, but this is a whole region of our solar system we didn't know much about. I've heard it called the third zone. What is this area, and what are we learning about it?
Well, right. That's the almost hidden significance of this mission, is that it's the first one to get us out into that third zone. So the first one is just the rocky planets of the inner solar system, of which Earth is a part, but also Mars and Mercury and Venus. And then beyond that, you have these great big giant gas planets of Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune. And then, for a long time, there was this outlier of a ninth planet that didn't really fit with any of the others, that was this Pluto that had this weird lopsided orbit, and it was super far away, and it was really tiny, rocky after all these gas giants. And what the scientists began to realize after a while is that maybe it isn't the ninth planet, but it's actually the first of a new kind of object in the solar system. It's part of what they now call the Kuiper Belt, which has a lot of other objects like Pluto. The ones they used to think were tiny, small, devoid of activity. But now that we've seen Pluto's example, all these other icy, rocky worlds out there might have this same kind of unusual activity and, their own surprises and mysteries all going on out there.
So, Bill, before we move on to the next story, what are the big lingering questions out here about this Pluto mission?
Well, there's still a lot of questions about what exactly is causing some of these formations on Pluto, and why it's Moon Charon, although there's some debate on how to pronounce it, why it doesn't look like it's a mini Pluto. It has very different set of features and systems than Pluto as well. So it's a fairly big moon. In fact, the moon doesn't orbit around Pluto. The two co-orbit around a central point. And that's how big this moon is. And so they expect it to be a lot like Pluto, but it isn't. And then beyond that, the New Horizons probe, which has already sped long past Pluto by now, is actually on its way toward another Kuiper Belt object that it will be reaching in another few years. So the big question will be, once it gets there, in 2019, they're thinking, what will it find? Will it be the same kind of amazing activity, or will that be more of a lifeless, by which I just mean not much activity kind of a world?
We're talking about the biggest stories from space throughout this year. We've got Bill Andrews with us from Discover Magazine. Let's get a little closer to home, Bill, and a Ceres, I believe, in the asteroid belt, right?
That's right. It's actually another dwarf planet. So Pluto isn't the only dwarf planet we got to see up close this year. Ceres beat it out by a few months when the Dawn mission entered orbit there in earlier in the year. And that is not just one of the asteroids in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, but it's actually the biggest one. In fact, they thought it was a planet when they first discovered Ceres in 1801. For decades, they thought it was another planet. So we'd actually never gotten a really good look at this world either. And when Dawn made it earlier this year, it finally saw that this is another vibrant world, that they weren't expecting quite as much activity. And the biggest mystery on this one is this really bright white dot, or actually series of spots in its biggest crater. And they weren't sure for a long time exactly what these white, almost, you know, luminous-looking spots could be. They think now it might be deposits of salt that are a result of some kind of activity, of geologic activity, but they're still not really sure. So the Dawn mission will will stay in orbit there for another while, and hopefully we'll find out a little bit more about these white spots and the rest of the world too.
And we're going to go now to another huge story from this year, that the Rosetta mission. What happened there? That was big news.
Right, and this one is almost a sequel to some of last year's big stories, because last year's, when the Rosetta mission first made it to and orbited and even sent a lander to a comet, the first time in our history that that's ever happened. So we got to see up close a comet for the first time last year and sent, as it turned out, ill-fated lander to the surface that was supposed to attach to the ground but kind of bounced around instead. And this year, it's still a big story because they've been able to get all that data and process it, as well as all those great pictures that they were getting. So they're able to learn much more about what makes this comet tick, and in so doing, what makes a lot of the solar system tick, because comets have this property where they've been out in deep freeze all this time. So if you can figure out what makes up a comet, you can figure out what made up the original solar system billions of years ago on Earth, and a lot of the planets, wind and water and erosion and all kinds of stuff has affected these materials. But out in the comets, a lot of this stuff is still pristine, and that's why they want to try and figure out exactly what it's made up of and what kind of properties it might tell us about the solar system.
And Bill, as I understand the universe, it's really big. But what's amazing mm-hmm. about these and other stories this year is how little we know, how many questions are still open about our own little neighborhood in the solar system.
That's right. This year in particular has had a ton of stories about the solar system, the ones we've been seeing, but also stuff about the sun and the moon and other moons of the gas giants, and just a huge year for planetary science in the solar system. Goes to show that it isn't all exoplanets and dark matter and galaxies, but there's a lot of mysteries we can still solve right here close to home.
And the final story in Discover's Top 100 is that the universe is dying. Mm. Thank God it's very, 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 very slowly, but it is dying. What do we know about that?
Right. Well, unfortunately, it will come to us all, and apparently the universe itself is no exception. And this is just the result of a study that astronomers have done chronicling the energy output of a number of galaxies, over 200,000, just to be able to compare some of the behavior of galaxies in the past to how they're acting in the present. And it turns out that they were much more productive in the past, even in just 2 billion years difference, which sounds like a lot, but it isn't that much in the universe's scheme. But even just 2 billion years ago, it was producing, the galaxies were producing twice as much energy. So if this trend continues, which it looks like it should, we have no reason to suspect otherwise, eventually the energy output of everything, galaxies and stars, and if mankind should be around, maybe us too, it's just going to keep dwindling and, you know, falling apart, and eventually all that's left is just going to be nothing new. All the stuff that in the universe without any energy to keep it moving or get any new stuff happening. So a bit of a bleak reminder of, you know, the fate of so many of us. But as we say in our story, too, if you're worried about this, it really isn't something that should occupy your mind. The sun will have gone out and Earth died way before the universe's time is up.
And so, on that cheery note, it's good. Thanks, Bill. Thanks for catching us up on the latest this year in science.
Thank you.
That's Bill Andrews, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine. He joined us to talk about the top space news from 2015.
As we ponder the heat death of the universe, a good time to look at the rise of positive thinking in American culture. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. There's an El Nino system currently brewing in the Pacific Ocean, and it's shaping up to be the biggest of its kind in nearly 20 years. The past, this weather cycle has brought warmer winter temperatures to Wisconsin, as well as more unpredictable weather around the world. What's this year's El Nino going to bring? You can learn more about the science behind El Nino and the possible effects it could have on us this winter at WPR.org/El Nino.
First, Americans tend to be known around the world for our positive thinking. We're the place where Oprah gained millions of viewers and her encouragement to be your best self, and bookstores are filled with self-help titles.
Even political messages like, yes, we can, enforce the idea that anything we put our minds to is possible. But how did we get to be a nation of positive thinkers? Mitch Horowitz tries to answer that question in his book, One Simple Idea, How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life. I spoke with Mitch Horowitz when the book came out.
How important do you think positive thinking is to American culture today?
It's really central to American culture. If it wasn't for the positive thinking movement, however we come down on it, we wouldn't feel like ourselves. You know, some of the best-known expressions in American life derive from positive thinking, whether it's yes, we can, or just do it, be all you can be, nothing is impossible. We talk in these terms, and without the positive thinking movement, our culture would look and sound very different.
Where did that come from in our history?
It really started in the mid-19th century in New England with a movement called the Mental Healing Movement, or the Mind Cure Movement. American medicine was in terrible condition for much of the 19th century. In fact, our medicine lagged behind the medical sciences in Europe. It was probably the one consistent area where development in the U.S. lagged behind Europe. And people were desperate for alternatives, so they began to look to prayer therapy and auto-suggestion and what would later come to be known as hypnotism and try to find ways of healing themselves. And many thousands of people decided that it worked and sought to use the mind as an agency to improve other areas of life, like career and finance and relationships.
And where did it go from there in terms of, you know, the medical claims? In general, you know, Americans, we are positive. Sometimes we're a skeptical lot, and we like there to be proof. Is there proof in the pudding that positive thinking works?
Well, most of the proof from that time was testimonial and anecdotal. It was interesting. You know, there were people who reported chores by using mental cure methods, and there were people who were struck by terrible tragedy by not seeking out standard medical care. It's just that standard medical care at the time was so poor, it was difficult proving whether it would have done any good, you know, had it been sought out, rather than using Christian Science methods, which was a religion that came out of the mental healing movement, or other forms of what was then known as mind cure. By the late 19th century, particularly with the opening of Johns Hopkins University Medical School, medicine got a lot better in this country, and by the 1890s, people weren't as desperate. There wasn't the same need to seek out alternative cures, although there were lots of them, homeopathy, botanical remedies, remedies and other things grew out of that era. But the country was changing, and the economy was really growing, and people were very eager and anxious to join the growing economy. And some of the people in the mental healing movement at that time, late 1880s, early 1890s, began to pioneer what later became known as the prosperity gospel, in which you would think and grow rich, as the expression goes.
Moving ahead a little bit, when I hear the phrase positive thinking, I think of The Power of Positive Thinking by Reverend Norman Vincent Peale. Mm-hmm. And as I understand it, I wasn't around when it came out, but this is a book that was all over the place in, what was it, the early 50s, 1950s?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You really can't exaggerate that book's impact. When that book came out in 1952, it became the best-selling book that had ever been published in America, with the exception of the Bible. I mean, it was a book that you would just find in every household. It's still quite popular today. And the author, Norman Vincent Peale, was a Methodist minister who grew up in Ohio. And during the Great Depression, he was placed in charge of a congregation on Manhattan's east side, a Dutch Reformed congregation. And Peale was politically and culturally a very conservative guy, but religiously, he was a great experimenter. And he was willing to look into all kinds of different methods, many of which had to do with positive thinking metaphysics. There were movements that ranged from Christian Science to New Thought, which was really the movement that the mental cure had morphed into. And Peale just experimented and looked everywhere. He was had an early interest in the thought of the psychologist Carl Jung. He was interested in the ideas of William James and the Transcendentalists. And Peale came to feel that the positive thinking thesis, which is that our thoughts are causative, could be supported by statements in Scripture. And so he proceeded to write The Power of Positive Thinking, and he made positive thinking into a household term.
Is there something that smacks of first world privilege about positive thinking at all, that you actually have the time to read these books and devote your time to thinking positively instead of, you know, working hard to earn money and put food on the table?
Yes, and that's a real flaw of the positive thinking movement. I think there has been value in this movement, but it became an American movement because ours for many generations was an expanding country, an expanding economy, and even though there were great differences and inequities and imbalances in wealth, we at least could have the ideal that the individual could raise him or herself up. And Americans believed in that, wanted to believe in that. And the fact is, you know, today you will find a positive thinking movement in America that touches every corner of the nation. And obviously, you're not going to find the same thing on other continents or in other nations where there's a great deal of poverty, where people are locked in a daily struggle to survive. To some extent, ours is a movement of geography, and I encourage people in the positive thinking movement to be cognizant of things like that, because positive thinking in America grew up hand in hand, partly because of the circumstances of America as a nation.
You raise some concerns throughout the book with the way the positive thinking movement has evolved, affected people, but by and large, it seems, looking at your book, like you're sympathetic to it. What's the positive side of positive thinking as you see it?
I am sympathetic to it. I criticize it a great deal, but I feel that the critics, while I will walk down the road with them a long way, they don't look closely enough at some of the possibilities that have emerged from this movement. Right now, we're in the midst of some really interesting studies into the placebo effect, something that we've known about for a long, long time, but that I think we are producing some really interesting new data in, and studies that are coming out of Harvard and UCLA and other medical schools. I think that the people in the positive thinking movement, first of all, they had a rough early idea of a genuine connection between our mood and our sense of physical well-being that I think has been borne out in part by placebo studies, by mind-body medicine, by the familiarity with which we talk about stress-related disease today, whether it be hypertension or ulcers or chronic back or neck or shoulder pain. There's a realization that stress and mood plays a genuine role in our lives. And I also think that within cognitive psychology, the recovery groups, support groups, the 12-step approach to addiction recovery, you have principles and ideas from the positive thinking movement. People very rarely refer back to that movement as an antecedent. But the positive thinkers, although they were using a religious language in the 19th century, they were really struggling with a very rough early conception of what later came to be known as the subconscious mind or the unconscious mind. And I think their efforts amounted to something.
I want to talk about what's been a bit of a centerpiece in the world of positive thinking, and that is this movie called The Secret, which
yes.
became kind of a runaway hit. It had roots, though, that went back far earlier. Can you tell us about that and where it came from?
Sure. One of the most ironic aspects of The Secret is that when it became popular in 2006, 2007, it directed people's attention to some of the old positive thinking classics. And one of the books that the movie repeatedly extolled and that became very popular was a book called The Science of Getting Rich by a man named Wallace D. Wattles, who had been a Methodist minister and a longtime exponent of what was known as the social gospel. What many of the people who rediscovered Wattles' books didn't realize is that he was a socialist through and through. He ran for Congress and for local offices in Indiana on the Socialist Party ticket of Eugene V. Debs. He was an absolute social progressive and radical who believed at the time that some of these avant-garde religious methods, like the metaphysics of the mind, could help smooth out imbalances in wealth. And if you read The Science of Getting Rich carefully and you kind of have a map of what you're looking for, there's unmistakable socialist and Marxist language in it. And when this book was republished in 2007, it went to the number one spot on the Business Week bestseller list, and it was a centerpiece of The Secret. It is basically a metaphysical expression of some of the ideas that came out of the social gospel, which was a radical Christian movement that translated the ethics of Christ into a conception of an equitable society, a socially just society. And that was an ironic early part of the development of the prosperity gospel. The prosperity gospel today is associated with mega churches and business motivation, but a lot of the early exponents of it actually believed that metaphysics along with social protest could be a way of creating a more equitable society.
Well, that seems weird to me, because a socialist perspective you'd think would be community-oriented, group-oriented,
right.
collective, where I think of The Secret as an individual. How am I going to make myself rich? I don't know The Secret,
that's right.
but that's the gist, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, back in the day, in the progressive era, there was an expression of socialism that was kind of more utopian. There was a novel, Looking Backward, by a man named Edward Bellamy, and he saw this world of mass luxury and plenty and leisure, and that was the vision that Wallace Wattles was coming out of. That vision by the 1930s and 40s disappeared from the positive thinking movement, so it translated more into what you do see in our time in The Secret, which is more of a radically individualist vision.
Coming up, we'll hear more of this interview with Mitch Horowitz and the role that Oprah Winfrey plays as we talk about his book, One Simple Idea, How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life.
Right now, here's a few headlines we're keeping an eye on this afternoon with Kristen Durst from WPR News.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're taking a listen back to our interview with Mitch Horowitz about his book, One Simple Idea, How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life.
Horowitz says one of the icons of positive thinking in the United States is Oprah Winfrey.
Well, she brought many metaphysical books into people's living rooms. And in a certain sense, Oprah was almost... someone would have become Oprah. You know, it was an inevitable phenomenon. Because
if Oprah didn't exist, we'd have to invent her.
Exactly. and we would have. I mean, really, every strain of self-help or therapeutic thought in this country intersects with the positive thinking idea, which is that our thoughts, in some measure or another, determine outcome. And Oprah was this enormously articulate person who was able to capture a therapeutic outlook that has really run throughout our country for a long, long time. When Ronald Reagan was first running for president, he would routinely say in his speeches, nothing is impossible. And Americans were able to connect with that because of generations of motivational psychology. Other presidents just didn't sound that way. Dwight Eisenhower didn't sound that way. Richard Nixon didn't sound that way. But after Reagan, every president had to sound that way. So when Obama was giving his State of the Union address in 2011, he uttered the line, "This is a country where anything is possible." And it was a leaf directly out of Reagan. So we all talk that way to a greater or lesser extent. And those of us who think, oh, gee, that's just shallow and superficial, you'll catch yourself every now and then actually using that phraseology. It's just in the groundwater of our country.
What does the brain research have to say about all this? If we hear a message, you know, from Ronald Reagan, anything's impossible, nothing's impossible, are there certain areas of our brain that just light up and get happy?
Well, there has been some interesting brain research at UCLA recently that touches on all this. There's an emerging field called neuroplasticity, in which researchers have found through brain scans that the actual redirection of your thoughts through certain ritualistic patterns can result in a change in the neural pathways, the pathways in which neurons fire in your brain. So, for example, this has implications for treating people who suffer from obsessive-compulsive disorder. Researchers have found that if people can actively and sustainably redirect their thoughts away from certain ritualistic behaviors, eventually, in cases of OCD, that will result in redirected neural pathways in the brain. And this is a promising field. So, you know, we do have some evidence within a certain window of study that shows that, our thoughts and our thought patterns do have some biologic implications for the brain.
We've got some callers who want to weigh in on this now.
Let's move on to Monica joining us from Greenville. Hi there.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I was not exposed to the positive thinking as a theology, so I couldn't say much about that. But I think it reminds me of my mother. We grew up Catholic, very devoted Catholic, but she has a still a very positive way of looking at life. And she used to tell us when we were growing up, especially the girls, if you frown at your hair, you are for sure going to have a bad hair day. And her attitude was always one of, there are going to be problems in life. As I said, being a Catholic, we believe that God is in the driver's seat, but we still have the option of buckling up or not. And to take problems and be a part of the solution, not the problem. So your call reminds me of that. It's a thing, a lighter way of seeing it, not as a theology or a religion.
So it sounds, Monica, like this is something you were okay growing up with it because it taught you that you could maybe have some choice, some volition about the way you thought about the world.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks so much for the call, Monica.
Yeah, I'm in great sympathy with what she said. You know, too often we hear these things and we think, oh, you know, don't tell me to have a nice day. It sounds so, you know, it sounds sometimes to people like it's immature or it's a sort of forced cheerfulness. But those ideas can go deeper and can represent more in a person's life than we sometimes understand. My mother-in-law is a devout Catholic, and she recently retired from a position as an associate dean at Harvard Medical School, a very accomplished person, and in many respects a very self-made person in the truest sense. She's absolutely dedicated to all kinds of positive thinking ideas and literature, and she has postcards and little business card-sized signs hanging up throughout her apartment that have all these positive thinking affirmations on them. And, you know, to the outsider, these things can sometimes seem like a forced display of cheerfulness. But for some people, they really do make a difference. They can flick a switch at certain sensitive moments that help an individual get through a stress or get through a difficulty of the day.
Mitch, looking toward the future, we've seen a lot of commentary over the years that we're getting more cynical. We're maybe more negative than we used to be. Do you see cynicism crowding out positive thinking in the United States?
I do, actually. The kind of discourse that goes on online and in texts and social postings, tweets and such, tends to be very, very coarse, and it's just endemic to our society. I think, actually, we are going through a really deep and substantial coarsening of our communication, and we as individuals are all going to have to take a look at that because it's going to reach a point of irreversibility where rudeness and cynicism and sarcasm just becomes quite normal. And it's very different from the kind of correspondence that people conducted, say, 30, 40 years ago. One of the reasons, among many, that the positive thinking movement grew to popularity in the early 19th century is that the economy was changing from an agricultural to an industrial and corporate base. People were flowing into jobs in large offices and professional workplaces for the very first time. They didn't always know how to act, what proper decorum was, what proper communication was. To an extent, there are positive thinking books that people sometimes make fun of today, like Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People, but those books answered a certain need. They helped people understand what was expected of them in terms of decorum in professional atmospheres. we are going to have to relearn those lessons in the digital age, because the degree, I believe, of cynicism and coarseness over digital communication is really becoming suffocating.
Mitch, thank you so much. We appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
That was an interview we did with Mitch Horowitz about his book, One Simple Idea, How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life.
And we want to hear from you. Is there a self-help book that you use to actually help yourself, that actually made a difference, that influenced the way you think or you behave? Let us know. Send us the title and the author. Tweet us at Central Time WPR, or you can send us a message on the Central Time Facebook page.